You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
This is Mixed Mental Arts. This podcast with Hunter Motz and Brian Callen. I mean, this is where you learn, guys. This is where you learn to organize your brain. This is where you learn to take the East and the West and mix it together. It's where you're not a blind man grabbing onto an elephant's tail and wondering, what's this rope? It's where you see the whole frickin' elephant. Sometimes you need a guide. You need a third guide. And that's why John Durant, who came to my home, and his hair brushes his shoulders. He's got a full beard. He's got broad shoulders, blue, a GNC blue eyes. I literally got lost in his eyes. And he's got some strong, by the way, he's got a strong haunches. He's built for the farm and the battlefield. Big, round, strong, sturdy American powerlifting thighs. He's no stranger to CrossFit and probably a little Olympic and maybe even some powerlifting. And then I got down to his feet, and his shoes belong in the movie Finding Dory. They're so adorable, I can't take it. They're simply adorable. So for the caveman with adorable feet, John Durant, welcome to Mixed Mental Arts.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You're welcome. And that's all I wanted to say. We'll see you later, guys. Tune in next week. Tune in next week. Yes. John, let's get into it, man. Let's get into it. We've been talking since you got here about sort of the state of the world and and how 50% of the country doesn't really talk to the other 50%, liberal versus conservative. Yeah. You want a big bet.
I want a huge bet.
And saying that Donald Trump was going to be president. Michael Malice, who's a friend of yours, was on our podcast and said he was going to be president. I have been saying from day one, there's simply no way. He doesn't have the votes, doesn't have the Latino votes, doesn't have the black votes, doesn't have the woman vote, doesn't have the Democrat vote. I was parroting my father because I don't have any of my own thoughts. But the point is, I was wrong. Why did you think Trump was going to win?
So I thought he was going to win for a few reasons. One is he actually has, unlike Mitt Romney, he actually has a blue-collar manner to him, even though he's a billionaire. He's sort of like if a blue-collar person won the lottery, be like, man, I want that life. I'm going to own, you know, the Miss America pageant, and I'm going to have my own, you know, 747. I'm going to marry a supermodel, and everything's going to be covered in gold, right?
That's so great. And because I have to say, when I saw Hillary's team, the closest, her circle, with her daughter and her daughter's husband and all that people, and then they looked like liberal intellectuals who had never really done any sports, had certainly done no military service, and had never punched anybody in the face. God forbid if they got punched in the face, they'd have to go through PTS counseling and training, and they'd have to go to a therapist. Whereas I looked over at Donald Trump's team, and they're all well over 6 feet, including the women. They look like they've been dipped in gold. They're so shiny and pretty and healthy. Meat eaters, meat, wheat, and milk.
It just seems like Ken and Barbie.
But they also look like sort of the conquerors, the Vikings that come in to those. You know, it's almost like when the Vikings came into the Seine and the French were all hanging out, and they were all about 5'4" eating cheese with their baguettes, and the Vikings come in like, what's with this, guys? Let's rape the land of the midgets over here. This is great. And they speak French. They sound like cats. Kill them, but rape first. I get it.
And then the women switch sides.
And then the women switch sides as well. They should because their DNA, they were like, these guys are hot Vikings.
They rub coconut oil on their chest.
That's right. That's at least what our fantasy is. Meanwhile, they were probably screaming and hating life.
That's when I knew Trump was going to win, when he rubbed coconut oil on his chest.
No, but that's a really interesting observation. But
So Romney got hammered for being wealthy and out of touch when he ran. And he's worth something like, I don't know, $200 million.
Yeah.
One of the moments I knew where Trump could win was it was brought up that Romney had this issue of being out of touch, and they're like, because he was so rich. And Trump's response was, he goes, Romney's not rich. I'm rich. Like, he didn't run away from it.
That is great. Romney's not rich. I'm rich. That is pretty. That's astounding. Yeah.
And that becomes aspirational. He doesn't run away from it. He doesn't get defensive. In fact, he exaggerated it. And then the psychological effect was all the people in the media started debating how much Trump was worth. Is he worth $3 billion? Is he worth $10 billion? Is he worth $7 billion? And so they're spending all this time. Like the net effect is this guy's worth a lot
well,
of money.
Because they anchored the word
right.
billion.
That's right.
And that's right. Well, the debate was, is it 3 or is it 10?
Yeah.
Either way,
yeah. Trump wins.
Either way, I don't give a shit. So like, yeah. if you said, Brian, you're worth $3 billion, then you came to me the next day and say, you're actually worth $10 billion. My happiness quotient would not go up even 1%. I'd be like, huh? Yeah. What? I guess I'll open another foundation.
As long as you're in the 7-figure club, right?
Yeah, that's crazy. That's right. Jesus. Yeah.
He would anchor conversations multiple times. And once you saw this, once I started to see it.
It's $9 billion. It's nine figure.
It's actually nine.
It's the nine figure. Yeah.
It's like a
microphone, right? Damn it. Yeah. Hunter, I'll give you mine.
The other time Trump anchored the conversation was in the debate over the wall. And he goes, and Mexico's going to pay for it. And whatever you think of this, the result was everybody in the media started debating how the wall was going to be paid for. So in people's heads, the wall was already going to be built, and they were only debating how it was going to be paid for.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And initially, it seems like an accident or he's getting lucky or something like that. But when he does it 40 times in a row.
So you think a lot of this was deliberate. He's a marketing master.
Yes.
Because it does seem like he really does anchor well. Like, so for example, this book that I'm almost done with is Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And, you know, he talks about how you can anchor when you negotiate. And it seems like Trump will say things like, NAFTA is simply the worst deal in the history of all deals. So all of us go, man, that must be a terrible, it's not that bad, but it can't be that good.
Right.
He's already anchored. He's already set the he's already set the number.
Right.
So you are already on the defensive.
Yeah. And he's very good at that. And he talks about these tactics in The Art of the Deal, which is written in the 80s. Mm. I read that over Christmas last year. And like he lays out a lot of his tactics like right there. And he's been using them for 35 years.
Wow. I've never read it. I should have.
And he talks about...
And the media should have read it.
Right. No such thing as bad press. And he would talk about how he would elicit like negative press because it's like it's still worth it to me. And people would still hear about it.
So do you think he's crazy like a fox then?
Yeah. I think he's shrewd. I think some of his moves are instinctive. He's just figured out that they work. He might... I don't know if he has like a grand theory of it all.
It sounds like he kind of does. I mean, at least his ability to I don't know if the word is manipulate, but certainly to get you thinking and collectively,
right.
I'm saying, get sort of you thinking in a certain way. He, whether you know it or not, you are being influenced by the way he is framing the issues,
That's right.
But I think the distinction between is this conscious or unconscious is an interesting one because it's the same thing with Kim Kardashian. Like nobody's going to say that Kim Kardashian isn't like one of the best people at social media ever, right? But the question is, does she sort of just do it intuitively? Has she sort of figured these things out? Or is there some sort of conscious plan? And I think the thing is that there's no question that Trump is amazing at getting power. But I wonder how well does he understand the world and how well is he – what vision does he aim to implement? Does he have a grand plan for how to actually create prosperity?
I mean, there are some issues where he's sort of been all over the map over the years. There are others where he's been pretty consistent. I mean, he was a critic of NAFTA back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. He was
also a critic of the Iraq War. He really was.
Yeah.
I mean, he had many an argument of saying that essentially it's going to destabilize the Middle East. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I actually do trust that he's being genuine on those points. The other thing on like he's a builder, right? That's what he knows. So I do think that no matter what happens in the administration, he's going to fall back on infrastructure mm-hmm. and infrastructure projects because that's where he's comfortable, like big you know, big infrastructure projects. And for things for presidents to be obsessed with, I don't think that's the worst thing in the world.
Mm. Especially the state of our infrastructure. Yeah. Like, our infrastructure is so bad. If we just spent 4 years fixing all the roads and railroads and all that sort of stuff, it wouldn't be a bad thing at all.
No, I don't think so either.
Yeah, I don't know what you do to when you raise that tax revenue or to pay for that. You might give yourself a hell of a deficit. I'm not an economist, but I know that's been an issue. But I think we do need, from what I've read or heard, we need better infrastructure.
That's
right. We do have a hell of a deficit.
Right.
And the question is, there's just two schools of thought, which is, one, we'll grow our way out of the deficit. We won't have to tax our way out of it. We'll grow out of our way out of it. Those are just two different points of view, a conservative and a liberal point of view. But for me, you know, when we talk about people are very good at social media, Kim Kardashian and, for that matter, Donald Trump, the thing that I am wary of is – when that is your ambition, when your ambition is ultimately to be the one people are talking about, and you're able to sustain that level of ferocity, that intensity. I mean, you know, for me, I have to live on social media. I'm a comic, so I have to post about my shows. I have to put graphics up. I have to do funny stuff. There's something about self-promotion that I find almost physically painful, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's because I've been, you know, I was raised to think that a man shouldn't do that, that that's not, it's gauche, that that's not, that that style doesn't make the man, substance makes the man.
Right.
And what it does is, you know, I was talking to Hunter, I'm not competitive. I am not a competitive guy. What I noticed that a lot of people have a competitive dynamic. And you see this with marriages. You're not giving 50%. I'm giving 80%. You're only giving 20. Yes, today that's true. But even when I see people who are very competitive with their career in Hollywood, like, you know, he got that movie or his ratings are high. And to my detriment, probably, I'm sure, I just have never,
right.
I just never gave a shit. That doesn't make me a better person, and it doesn't mean I'd be a better leader. I'm using myself as an example.
It can corrupt you if you care about it too much.
Well, yes. I guess my heroes have always been the people that take themselves out of the equation and put something like solving the big problems, engaging in the big ideas, and putting themselves last.
Yeah.
That's... I mean, think about the heroes that we have, and those are the people that we talk about. And the people like Donald Trump, the people like Henry VIII, who put Sir Thomas More to death because he wouldn't accept the Anglican Church. The people that we write plays about.
Oh, you had to choose the guy that he put to death.
By the way, and all his wives, yeah. This was a common man who was put in a position of power, who had a lot of ambition, volume, and energy.
Here's my hope.
Yeah.
Here's my hope. And I think it should be the hope of all Americans at the beginning of anybody's presidency, Obama, whoever. You want the president to succeed. You want the country to succeed. My hope, Donald Trump, one of the roles that he's played in his career is as a host of a hotel. Mm-hmm. And I hope that he adopts that mentality to say, I want your experience to be the best.
I think that's a really, that's what I hope as well, and I think that's a really good way to put it, and a very interesting distinction.
Because he's played that role.
He's played that role, and I don't think he's an ideologue. I think ideologues are dangerous, always.
Yeah.
I think Trump is practical. And so, yes, I think he's a pathological narcissist. That's what I worry about.
Right.
I worry that he's not interested in what he doesn't know sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I may be wrong, and that's a characteristic that I haven't seen a lot of examples of where he's not that. However, I don't know him. I don't know what his day-to-day is. I do know that when you are trying to solve problems, when you own a huge business, you are constantly trying to solve problems, which means you have to take in information and you have to then figure out how to solve those problems, delineate authority and stuff like that. I don't know how well he does that, but I don't think he's the worst guy in the world at that. At least he's had experience at that.
Right. And so, you know, building a, you know, we can talk about he doesn't have a perfect business record and all that sort of stuff, but building a large construction project in a city like Manhattan involves what? At least a dozen different agencies, whether it's the bank, whether it's environmental zoning, the mayor's office, all sorts of stuff like that. So you know, he has shown himself capable of managing complex projects with a lot of moving parts. But you know what? We're about to find out. We're about to see. There's so many contradictions to him, because there's the over the top luxury and the gold and the big letters and that part of him, and then there's the part that never drinks, never smokes, never touched drugs, and his kids turned out real nicely. So there are a lot of contradictions. There's the guy who talks tough and is the deal maker, and we're going to play hard with Mexico and all this sort of stuff. And then there's the guy who's the host of the hotel and comes up and he's polite and says, "I want you to have the best time ever here."
I had a really interesting conversation with Katie O'Brien yesterday, who we work with a lot. But the I think that part of the thing that is really interesting is the sort of leader that you're talking about, Brian, right? The leader who, puts the country first and themselves last, right? Which is, the great heroes like Cincinnatus, right? Cincinnatus is given power by the Roman Republic. He's made dictator. And yet after having that total power, he gives it up. He solves the crisis and he hands power back to the people, and he goes back
George
to
Washington.
George Washington's hero was Cincinnatus. Yeah, and so he was member of the Order of Cincinnatus, and that's why Cincinnati's called Cincinnati. But the point is that those are the great heroes, and in terms of, since we're all friends of science here and friends of evolutionary biology, there is this recurring tension in human history where in the face of a great crisis, the people pull together, right, and they face the challenge, right? And then, there's inevitably a complacency that sets in and a certain selfishness. And I think a part of what we have to
decay and collapse.
Well, that is the possibility, but I think that part of the there is the greatest generation is the greatest generation because they are forged by the Great Depression and by World War II.
Right.
And my real experience during this election was being fundamentally dissatisfied with both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump because they are baby boomers and they are part of that me generation. And they're interested in power for themselves, and they don't have a real understanding of how to solve the challenges or the problems that we're facing. And I think that the other narrative that I think that we have to talk about is the degree to which that generation and that mindset has failed us, and we need a fundamentally new, different form of leadership.
Well, to continue on that, there's a certain shamelessness to Trump, right?
Yeah.
In some ways, he was a man for the moment because the left has weaponized shame. Mm-hmm. They've used shame as so aggressively as a weapon that only someone
that
was shameless could withstand all the social pressure. And there was a ton. I mean, can you imagine how many people could endure a campaign where they're repeatedly and aggressively by the entire media, pretty much, basically called literally Hitler?
And that's right. Compared to Hitler, really called essentially a rapist, or at least somebody who sexually assaults women and young underage girls.
Yeah.
Somebody who makes fun of handicapped people, which I actually looked at. I don't think he even knew who he was talking about. He's not articulate,
right?
And he's clumsy with his. He's clumsy. He's not.
He's blunt.
He's not refined or elegant. He's a giant. He's a bull in a china shop. And that is one of the things that the New York Times and the New York liberal media has lost a lot of credibility with me. I don't even read the New York Times the same way I do anymore.
Yeah.
I think that they have such a strong agenda, and it was really hard for them. And I understand that Trump rubbed them the wrong way in every aspect of their lives. But it does, Camille Paglia has been talking about this a lot. The liberal New York media and a lot of the sort of at least the elite on the Democrat side, and probably some on the Republican side, it's no longer, none of them have really done, first of all, not only military service, not a lot of contact sport. I know this sounds crazy, but also they have not really, they're a whole generation removed from anybody who really does manual labor.
Right.
That really does struggle with sort of that objective reality of getting on the bus, your back is killing you, whatever it might be. There was this woman who was, she was an anthropologist or something. She was on a bus.
Anthropologist.
She was an anthropologist. It's the study of man and birds. She's an anthropologist.
LOLologist.
She's an anthropologist, and I think she was, but she said something really interesting. She was on the bus with all these black women who are working the service industry. They take care of sick people, and usually, you know, and they do all kinds of different stuff, hospitals and stuff. You know what they were talking about? The conversation was around this new kind of aspirin that helps your back pain, and all of them were interested in it. All of them.
Yeah.
There was a certain reality to their life, sitting on that bus with those uncomfortable seats. They were overweight, and they were in pain. They were in physical pain. They don't sleep that much because they're the sole breadwinner. There's all kinds of shit. She was like, man, I have no idea how to live this way. I have no idea what they're going through, really. There's an organic reality,
yeah,
a tactile reality that I think the media, the liberal New York media, and I have my own problems with the conservative media, but they are very much out of touch. And I think also when they start talking about how everybody is a racist and everybody is a xenophobe and everybody is a sexist, and they brand you, and you're not allowed to sit at the table, man. They just dismiss an entire human being, that complicated organism with much to give and say.
I mean, in 2012, when the gay marriage, I believe it was the year when the gay marriage ruling came down, and so that sort of culture war had been won, there was a moment where, for a few years, there could have been peace in the culture wars, and basically the nation could have come together a little bit after, you know, a few decades of pretty aggressive culture wars, going both ways, initiated by both sides, but the left has been winning more over the last decade. And I think that would have been a very good thing for the country. But instead, we launched right into the trans culture war.
It's
right?
So nuts.
And suddenly, 70% of the country, like anybody who's like, I'm not quite sure how I feel about, like, okay, let's
I think
respect
it's
and
weird.
Love other people.
Right. No. Okay, so Bruce Jenner is woman of the fucking year. That guy who did the last time he did anything was in 1976. That guy who's had been feminizing his looks, that guy who married Chris Kardashian, whatever her name is, that's the woman of the year. All the women, the real women out there. And you choose some dude who decides at 65, I want to be a woman. Hey, all power to you. Am I going to censor you? Hell no. Would I ridicule you? Hell no. I'm for fair play. I think it's fucking weird. Yeah. I'm allowed to. Yeah. Don't tell me he's beautiful or she's beautiful. She's not. She's not at all. And she's also, and I'm allowed to think it's weird and strange, and doesn't make me a bigot. It doesn't make me prejudiced, and it doesn't make me unfair. I'm allowed to say, whoa, I've known that guy as Bruce Jenner forever. And that one time athlete in 1972 and 76, the last time he did anything. And now he's the woman of the fucking year. And now you guys are bothering me about transgender bathrooms. And now you're bothering me about the kind of pronouns that are being enforced on people for people that identify neither as men or women, which is, I think there are three of them. I don't even know what the fuck you're talking about.
They're all sitting right
there. I don't even know what you're talking about, these cuckoo birds.
Yeah.
And so they lose you. I'm a liberal dude. You know what I am? Me especially.
Yeah.
I'm all about fair play, and I can't stand to hurt anybody's feelings. Yeah. I'm talking about me. Yeah. Just take me as an extreme example.
Right.
I am a big baby, but I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I have fantasies about breaking into North Korean prison camps and feeding everybody soup. I have fantasies about, I was, as in high school, I was protective of anybody. There was this gay, he was so gay, this boy, he was so gay. And all I want to do is make him know that I didn't care and that I would protect him.
Yeah.
That's me. And I hate all those motherfuckers now. Not people who are transgender, but these social justice warriors who are taking up my time with transgender bathroom and all this discussion and boycotting and being so aggressive and tyrannical. They have turned me, people like me, and I'm a complete pussy, people like me against them. I wonder what it's done to people who have less tolerance.
Yeah.
And I sympathize. I sympathize with people who have, you know, it's a snake eating its own tail. They have not been bridge builders.
And it's actually, people have been talking about the alt-right. It's this aggressive use of racism and social justice warriors and stuff like that. I believe they are largely responsible for the rise of the alt-right. If you think about,
yes,
the metaphor that I use is like antibiotics. So, right, if you overuse antibiotics, you breed antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and then it comes back to haunt you. And, you know, antibiotics should be used judiciously. At key moments, when there's a strain of something that could kill everything, that's when you use it. But otherwise, you don't use it, because then you breed this real nasty stuff that it's going to... So that's sort of like they've overused racism and these other words.
But it's also like if you have any knowledge of history, you know that any movement generates a counter-movement.
Right.
Right? There's action-reaction. You have the Enlightenment, then you have the Romanticism, right? You have these cookie-cutter, like, suburbs that come after World War II, and then you have the hippies, right? You know, so there's always... You can't hit up one thing. I mean, the real solution is ultimately to create a worldview that is inclusive and incorporates everybody. And guess what? They did that back in 1776. It's a really simple ideology. All people are created equal. And
it needed to be improved upon.
It did need to be. It wasn't lived fully.
Right.
Right. I think of it like essentially the golden rule. Right. You nailed the principle. Principle was perfect. Now you just have to fucking live it. Right.
Right.
And so we didn't fully live it. And now, I mean, I think for me, because Brian and I, you know, grew up all over the world. And so, you know, our brains have been a mess for a long time when we're like, we seem like we're all the same, but yet we also seem really different. And how does that work? And it is that question of what is our shared humanity? And then what are these cultural differences? And what are the consequences of these cultural differences? And, you know, sort of the refinement that comes out of all this science, people like Joe Henrich at Harvard and all that sort of stuff, is that all people are created equal, but not all cultures are equally suited to every environment. And
I mean, every individual is different. Everybody
well,
is.
That's the challenge of mixed mental arts, is to sort through all that science.
There's a moral principle, and then there's biology. The moral principle is everybody is equal, and everybody, except for kids.
But I do think that this I know what you're getting at, John, because when you say all men are created equal, it's a Judeo-Christian ethic, the notion that we're all of the same moral worth.
Right.
That's where you should start. In other words, if I kill a wretch on the street versus Bill Gates, I should do the same amount of time in jail because he's one of God's creatures or whatever. He's a human being. I think, though, that
say it like you mean
I don't think that all people are created equal. I do think certain people have innate talents or more energy or they're taller or they're stronger. There are a lot of differences. But think about what Jordan Peterson was saying on – I was listening to Joe Rogan's podcast with him, and he said the whole point is that you're always trying to strive out of equality. You want to work hard so you can get better than other people. I mean, that's that ideal has to also be cherished. I mean, the idea that, you know, if you work smart, if you have the right tutelage, if you expose yourself to the right things, the right culture, the right, you know, if you borrow from other cultures, if you borrow from other thoughts, if you immerse yourself in the best that's been thought and said, if you learn through attrition and perseverance and attention, daily attention, you will become better. You will be somebody that all eyes are on, that people want to emulate, right?
You have to distinguish, right? So obviously all people are created equal. Not all cultures are equally suited to an environment is whatever, 10, 12 words, right? It's a simplification. It's a generalization. Now, if you want to talk about specific biological differences, yes, obviously, like if you're from Biafra, then, you know, you're going to have certain genes for like explosive muscles and all that sort of stuff, as opposed to if you're from the East Coast. Are there biological differences between men and women? 100%. But, you know, what is that core sameness? And that core sameness is that all people upload a culture from their environment, right? The secret of human success, that's the point of Joe Henrich's book, is that what set us apart from all the other primates is our ability to upload culture and to improve culture and run better and better and better software. So the opportunity in terms of that getting better is to start looking at what is our cultural software? What is the cultural software of the left? Well, it's this obsession with identity politics, and, you know, that's fundamentally, Thomas Sowell, right, says this better than anybody. Identity politics is a fundamental denial of the American belief in our sameness, right? It's that, you know, we're so fundamentally different, all these different groups, and that I as a white man can't possibly know what it's like to be a black person or to be, you know, feel oppressed because, you know, your gender identity is not recognized or anything like that. And the
And also, more insidious is the fact that because the only reason you're not ahead is because you've been oppressed. Yeah. There is only one enemy, and that would be oppression. And that the oppressor must be, in fact, corrected, burned down, quarantined, all of the above.
A boot on their face.
This is forever. The Soviet Union. This is not unique to history.
Right.
And so we have to be very careful of that, because obviously that is not the only factor.
Right.
There are other things, and human beings always want power over other people. And what happens is, you're right, there's always a counter movement to that.
Fundamentally, it's not even the largest factor. The largest factor in human success is culture. And so, you know, what Sowell has spent his life fighting against is the fact that, you know, black people have a culture that is redneck culture, right? Their culture was taken from them, and they picked up this honor culture that rednecks have, that it does not like education, is arrogant, uses violence too much, all of that sort of stuff. And that if you really want to help black people who live in the ghettos, you need to be honest with them and tell them your culture is the problem, right? You can keep the symbols, you can keep the music, you can keep all that stuff, but some of those core values need to change. And instead, identity politics has defended a culture that is setting these people up to fail.
That's a very controversial thing to say, but you could say the same thing. I mean, this is hillbilly elegy. Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, and Black Rednecks, white Liberals, written by a black scholar.
By Thomas Sowell,
yeah. Those are very controversial, but I do think they have a lot of value, because that's how you confront. See, that's the other thing, and I don't know if you know this, but I don't think that the majority of sort of these social justice warriors or the people on the left who tend to get very sensitive to all these kinds of all this talk, I don't think they're that interested in solving a problem. If they were, they'd be interested in telling the truth and talking about the truth. It's very uncomfortable, but they're not. They're more interested in being liked, like me, pious, and all that stuff.
Yeah. It one of the living here in Los Angeles and, you know, working in the industries that I do, sort of in tech and publishing and stuff like that, there aren't that many people who are sympathetic to Donald Trump, right? So I didn't broadcast it, aside from some Twitter and some people who know me and that I'm close with, but I just did not insert politics into with coworkers and things like that. And one of the interesting things that I noticed was I felt like I was in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually made me very sympathetic to gay men, lesbian women who have had to keep part of their identity hidden.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time on a very visceral level that I had felt what it might be like to be in the closet about something like a key part of your identity.
Mm-hmm.
So it was.
What did you not like about Hillary?
Ooh, how long do we have? I didn't want. Going into the election.
First of all, are you surprised the Democrats were stupid enough to nominate her? What happened with that? Why were they? Didn't they know? Didn't they see 8 years ago that didn't work? 4 years ago? What?
It was the
French Revolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, the point is that, you know, what did Marie Antoinette think when she saw those peasants outside with pitchforks? She was like, had lived in a bubble for so long that she was like, what is going on? And the Democratic Party in the middle of the French Revolution ran Marie Antoinette. They're like, here, this is our candidate, the most establishment French monarchist.
I mean, you know, she struck a deal basically with the Democratic Party and the Obama administration that she, when she lost to Obama, she sucked it up, which I give her credit for, and she took a role in the administration, and I might not agree with the decisions that she made, but she traveled all over the world as Secretary of State, and she put in the time, and she put in the work. And, you know, I think the agreement was, okay, well, she gets to be the nominee after all this.
Wow. Dummies.
Right. And she did have an angle for the social justice warriors. Which worked great in California and worked great in New York, but didn't play in Michigan or Wisconsin or Ohio, that, you know, we're going to have the first female president. So I think that's what.
But she was just arrogant. There was an arrogance.
Yeah. Well, and Bill's, like, the key insight of Bill's campaign in the 90s was, it's the economy, stupid. James Carville, yeah. Right? And she didn't have an economic message.
No.
She didn't have
it. That was my thing. It was just the same. She was essentially parroting Obama. And you had about 60 million voters that Obama's policies didn't work for them. At least it didn't feel like it worked for them. I mean, they were like, my life is going to stay the same. I got some problems here. Industry's leaving, et cetera, et cetera.
And there's no way. Obama had a historic presidency as the first black president. There's no way black people were going to show up with the same turnout rates that they did for Obama.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way. It could have been anybody running, and they wouldn't have turned out at that level.
Well, I guess fewer Democrats voted this election, or a lot of people just didn't come out.
Well,
Hillary was very low energy.
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning of this whole election, the worst outcome in my mind would have been Bush v. Clinton, right? It's what everybody was sick of. It's like these political dynasties in an era when inequality is bad, the middle class is getting hollowed out, a lot of the gains are going to the top, and we, like, are really the best people that our country can put forward just happen to be part of these political dynasties? No. Like, they're obviously not the best picks, and people are sick of, you know, we've seen that both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have pretty similar policies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, there are definitely some major differences, you know, if you're gay or something like that, where there are meaningful differences. But in terms of war, in terms of spending, they're pretty much the same.
Well, because we had Lawrence Lessig on, you know, when he was running for president. And part of the point that he made is that there's big money. And big money is sucking up to Wall Street and doing all that sort of stuff. And there the parties are the same. And then there's, you know, small money. And the small money is around social issues. And that's where your incentive is to diversify. And so that's essentially what both of the parties done. And it's all to maximize fundraising. But I think the other thing that I, you know, just in terms of this election that I found so bizarre and so frustrating, I mean, you know, again, just to be clear, like, I think that both of these candidates were terrible candidates, right? Both Trump and Clinton. And part of it is because what has, you know, Trump told to my Midwestern relatives, many of whom voted for him, this narrative that there were 1,000 jobs here, those 1,000 jobs went to China, and those 1,000 jobs are going to come back. And the reality is that a lot of these jobs are just being taken by robots and automation.
See, I heard you say this to Malice,
yeah,
and I disagree. First of all, of course, a job that went overseas 10 years ago or 5 years ago, like, that job is over there. But you know, look at Carrier. Like, there are companies right now in America that are thinking about offshoring. They're weighing the pros and cons. And guess what? For a bunch of them, it's a toss-up. They're like, yeah, maybe we could, maybe we shouldn't. And they're sort of on the edge. Why shouldn't we try to keep those folks who are on the edge here? Like, I don't,
you know,
I don't
that,
see
that's
a problem
that's
with
that. One thing. I don't know that so much of it was in the brain of if people want jobs to stay here. I also think that people voted for Trump because he was, you know, that he felt, even though he lied a lot, I mean, he's exaggerated, he felt so authentic and real.
Yeah.
And he, for me, I didn't like him, and I voted for Hillary Clinton because The Economist endorsed Hillary. And I read too many people who'd been in government for too long saying, this guy's a clear and present danger. And I just never liked
him. And you're
I don't
a pussy.
I'm a pussy, and I don't like pathological narcissists.
Yeah. No, I
couldn't get past that personally. Yeah. I couldn't get past it. I didn't look at some of the things you're talking about, and I wish I had. I don't think I still would have voted for him, but it's made me more, maybe, empathetic. I was very careful never to criticize any Trump supporters because I understood.
Right.
But I think a lot of it was just this visceral reaction to saying, I don't like that fucking, that woman who's talking to me in language I don't understand and has no relevance and certainly isn't going to give me the dignity that I want to get back. Yes, jobs may be going overseas. Yes, there's automation. I think they all know that. That people know that we are, that technology is expanding. There's an exponential rise in technology. It's very scary. We are talking about robots. I mean, people know about robots. People know that their jobs may be gone. But they...
So this comes down to, you know, firstly, you live in California, right? You guys are in tech, right? And to some extent, or media or whatever. So you're aware that these trends are happening, right? There are currently 3 million trucking jobs. And, you know, in all of the big companies plan to like roll out, there are already automated trucks. And there's a huge amount of people who support those jobs. And a lot of this, if you talk to people,
it's truck driving is the most common job in 49 of 50 states.
Yeah.
Outside of Hawaii.
So the point is that a huge amount of jobs in America are based on trucking. And if you talk to people who are in Silicon Valley, they're like, this is just going to come down to a safety issue. Like 90% of deaths on roads are caused by truckers and human error. So if you don't want people to die on roads, then you have to switch over to automated trucks.
3D printing.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a whole bunch of jobs. Those jobs disappear, and if you go to towns like Russell, Kansas, where Bob Dole is from, the whole town is one giant truck stop. That's 90% of, you know, what the business there is about, is gas stations, motels, strip clubs, diners, all of that sort of stuff. So the point is that there is a meteor coming at humanity, and I agree with you. Like, if we can, in the short term, keep 1,000 jobs here or whatever it may be, that's great. But it's a problem in the United States where 10% of Americans are in manufacturing. But when China no longer can do manufacturing, you're going to have a lot of people who have real, real problems.
Well, but in my mind, that militates for not having mass unskilled immigration, or not nearly as much of it. If we had figured out upward mobility for existing American citizens, there are large groups of American citizens that don't have opportunity and upward mobility. And so, to me, it seems like we're putting millions of people at the bottom of a broken escalator, and sort of expecting them magically to move up in the world, at the same time when automation is happening and is automating more and more unskilled jobs, it doesn't seem wise, it doesn't seem prudent to take 10 million more people and be like, here, we're going to put you at the bottom right now, but don't worry, your jobs will be automated away in 3 years.
They're already there. What would you do about immigration? I think the wall is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Well, see, here's the thing. I mean, like, first of all, there's already a wall on parts of the border. You know, many countries have walls or fences or barriers. Homes, you know, your home. Oh, I'm looking at a wall.
Yeah,
behind, like, you know. So,
but do you really think a wall of any kind would keep human beings out?
Yes.
Really?
Because they have throughout history.
First of all, it's not realistic. Getting that wall to be built through all that private property, good luck. It would cost $40 billion. Good luck with all of it. Getting Mexico to pay for it. It's insane. A wall. A wall?
Sure.
Well, this is not the Mongols and China with the Great Wall of China. It's nuts.
Also, by the way, the Great Wall of China didn't work.
Yeah, there's got to be a better way to do this in terms of building essentially walls. Proverbial walls, or walls around benefits, walls around getting into schools.
But in California, all the trends are pushing in the other direction, where liberals in particular are making it easier for illegal immigrants to get access to schools, to get access to services. So,
But it just seems that if that's the case, it would make more
Robert
sense.
Robert Frost, good walls make good neighbors. I don't think it has to be antagonistic. Like, there's already barriers on a third of the border. There's a physical wall in much of California along, like, the California-Mexico border. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you have
to. They just dig tunnels underneath.
Yeah.
But that's harder. I mean, you look at Israel. You look
harder.
At Israel and the walls there.
This feels so much like the war on drugs. I mean, we have spent in the past 30 years a lot of money on drug enforcement. How is it fucking going? How is it going? I'll get you cocaine right now. It's just not going well. And so I just worry that when you talk in terms of, it's almost like you want to stop terrorism. I remember these hilarious conversations. How do we make our buildings in New York City sturdier? Well, there may be a better way.
So, hold on. On two sides of America are
oceans,
yeah. Right? So, oceans make it really hard.
Not digging a moat.
We're digging a moat, and we're putting alligators in it.
No fucking moats.
And
no
Canada's going to pay for it.
All right. Well, now you're talking. All right.
And the cool thing about oceans is, or the interesting thing, it prevents it, at the same time, it prevents people from coming over, but it also allows people to come over, right? It has this dual nature. Like, you can't just swim across, mm-hmm. and so there's some sort of barrier, but you know, there are mechanisms of getting in mm-hmm. and arriving.
Yes.
And that's what I think a good border looks
yes.
like in anything.
You're right.
Which is there's some ability to keep out, but there's also an ability to let in. And there's a right amount of sort of fixed and flexible. It's same of any biological organism.
You're right. I mean, I think you're right in terms of I think that there has to be legal immigration is very important to
yeah.
promote. Illegal immigration isn't fair to people who've gone through the process. And I don't disagree with that. I guess what I'm talking about is methodology. I wonder if, you know, because there are a lot of Mexicans, from what I understand, there was a lot of Mexicans going back to Mexico because there wasn't work, as much work here in the United States. But we need also, there are a lot of people in the agricultural industry to be like, look, don't, be careful here.
Right.
I need these people.
Well, see, so here's...
I really wonder, say you took all restriction off the borders.
I think that would be disastrous.
Would it be disastrous or would it find an equilibrium?
I view it, the idea of open borders to me sounds like communism. It's this global ideology that mm-hmm. isn't actually rooted in human nature. Like, human nature is people form groups mm-hmm. and they form, you know, nations and tribes and nations.
It'd probably be dangerous to have open borders.
I think
it
would be dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, terrorists and, you know, you need a vetting process.
Any institution or organism, like there's no living organism in nature that in its own body has open borders. Like it would cease to exist. If you look at any institution that achieves excellence, whether it's Facebook or Harvard or NFL, there are limits on who can be there. And now look, like a nation doesn't have to be as selective as an NFL team or something like that. It could be.
If it wants to be a great nation, it should be.
Right, right. And, you know, but this idea that, like, you know, to have Mark Zuckerberg, who I'm sure is a very nice person, but to have him, like, come from all these exclusive settings that have incredible limits on who can participate, from Facebook to be an employee or an engineer there, Harvard, his, you know, the prep school where he went or the school where he went, like, you know, he has walls around his home. Like, he lives in a walled world. And then he talks about, you know, the importance of immigration, all that sort of stuff. Facebook right now doesn't hire very many Hispanics, even second or third generation Hispanics. So it's like, how about you start hiring some of these people who have already been here for a while, and then we'll listen to you about immigration policy.
But also,
let me just rant. Just
do it.
I do think there's a difference between unskilled immigration and skilled immigration. If somebody comes over here, they're going to start a business, you know, they're going to create jobs, great. That's wonderful. It's part of our ethos. But like this acceleration of technology and to create potentially an underclass, at least for a generation or two, even if it's just agricultural labor, these other things, I think it's dangerous to have potentially a semi-permanent underclass. A lot of kids, for their summer jobs used to do like one of three things. They'll work in a restaurant, or they'll do like gardening or, you know, landscaping and stuff like that, or they'll like take care of kids. Well, like in many parts of the country now, all those sectors are basically done by Hispanics and recent Hispanic immigrants. Wonderful, hardworking people. I don't have a bad thing to say about them. But then there are kids these days and people these days who say, I don't want to do those jobs because those are the jobs that other people do. And I don't think that's a good attitude. I think it's a better attitude to say, I'm going to clean my own shit. I'm going to clean my own toilet and get used to that and have our kids be used to that. And if there's these whole swaths of jobs, it's like the most extreme example of this is Saudi Arabia, where the Saudis are so wealthy and they import all these Indians and Pakistanis to do all their work for them. Now, obviously, that's an extreme example, but it's not pretty over there.
Mm-mm.
Like, you've got these really selfish, entitled, wealthy natives, and they have all the other people doing these jobs, and none of the Saudis will touch that stuff anymore because it signals that you're low status.
It's the same thing as slavery. There was a great thing in Booker T. Washington, Up from Slavery. He talks about how one of the like really damaging effects of slavery on white people was the fact that work became shameful. And so then afterwards, when slavery ended, they couldn't support themselves. And so often their former slaves would end up having to still take care of Massa because they didn't know how to.
Yeah. Well, those are the Southerners talk like this. I just tried to get the mic and talk this. That's right.
Well, but the same argument. This is an extreme example, so I'm not saying it's like directly comparable. But when slavery took place, the argument was we need cheap agricultural labor.
That's right.
And
I love your perspective on this stuff. It's pretty eye opening because it's a much needed perspective that I again have not heard. I got
to
start.
And I care. I used to be more sort of Randian, sort of ultra-libertarian, every man for himself, sort of.
That's a young man's. And I always say Ayn Rand is somebody you read as a young man, and you just get – I remember just being intoxicated. And I remember saying to my teacher, Ayn Rand. And I had an intellectual history class. And this, I can't remember his great teacher. And he said, man, he was kind of like, well. I said, what? What? John Galt?
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah, I just don't like Christ figures. I don't believe in them. And just, you know, I was like, but I'm a young man. It's like the first time I read Nietzsche, The Genealogy of Morals. I was like, I'm going to fucking be a warrior.
Yeah.
And the weak should die. And God, you know, anyway.
Well, yeah, Rand puts testosterone on a pedestal, basically.
Yeah. I mean, she says things like, you know, her characters say, nothing out of nature is beautiful. Only man-made. Like, she'd look at a forest and be like, why is this not being developed?
Well, and she had very specific theories of art. And if you didn't adhere to, like, her style of architecture, you were wrong.
I love watching interviews of her. I'll watch her eyes dart around, and she's just...
She had an amphetamine habit.
Oh, did she?
She did.
Did she?
It was like diet
that
pills.
That makes sense, because I would watch her, and I'm like, her eyes are fucking darting.
Yeah.
What's going on here? She couldn't wait to get, you know, come back at the guy. You know.
But I care more about equality and community than I used to. And I am concerned when I look at a state like California. It's very unequal. There's a lot of different ethnic groups living in their own ethnic enclaves in different parts of the city or different parts of the state, and the middle class isn't here as much, and that concerns me. Yes, there's incredible innovation coming out of Silicon Valley. There's incredible stuff coming from all over the state, but I don't necessarily view it as a cohesive and equal.
Well, a lot of the innovation going out of Silicon Valley is job killing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it just is. It's also job creating. I mean, Uber's great and Airbnb generates income, but...
But the point is that it creates three jobs while destroying 10,000. And so, you know, I mean, that's the thing that is really nuts about all of this is the degree to which liberals are appalled at this thing that they created. Like, this is Silicon Valley's toxic waste. Like, you've been pumping out job destruction for decades and decades and decades. And the point is if you talk to economists or you read Rise of the Robots or any of that sort of stuff, this stuff has been happening since the 70s, and specifically in terms of where the middle class goes. What are middle class jobs? They're high skill jobs. What are skills? Routine work. What do robots love? High routine skill work. It's the middle class is being destroyed by Silicon Valley and by all this creative destruction.
And even Uber and Airbnb, I've heard other people articulate this idea. It's not mine. They're innovative in some sense, but they're not in one way of looking at it. They're not really a sign of progress. They're a sign that we're poorer, because if people now to make a living have to rent out part of their two biggest assets, their home or their car, if they have to like spend time being like a mini like hotel owner or a mini taxi cab driver, is that really a sign of a growing society, or is it a sign that we're not as wealthy as we used to be, and so we're just finding ways to utilize the existing assets we already have, like, a little bit better.
But, well, just to throw something...
And I realize a lot of people have benefited from Uber and Airbnb, so I'm not saying it's, like, doom and gloom, but...
But let's get really paleo here, right? Ooh. So the point is that I think the opportunity, right, how do we actually move forward, is to create a genuine global village, right? And there are...
I don't know what the fuck that means.
Well, no, and I'll...
What's a genuine global village?
I'll tell you what that means, right? So for... Well, no, but...
Sounds like a Hillary Clinton book.
No, but I'll tell you exactly what that means. Firstly, let's talk about immigration, right? So the real problem with immigration, and, you know, the right is not very good at articulating this, is the fact that people come here with a culture. And culture drives our choices, and many of those cultural values do not set you up to succeed. Yes, successful institutions are exclusive because they're defending their values, they're defending their beliefs. So what you find, for example, in education, is this very bizarre phenomenon where someone like Mark Zuckerberg, right, is, you know, the whole cornerstone of Silicon Valley's culture is failing fast. It's embracing mistakes and using mistakes to get better. What do most American students not do? They don't use their mistakes. They get a bad test grade and they throw that away. So why is Mark Zuckerberg not promoting his own culture, the very value that makes his culture successful?
Okay. I'm going to try to say this in the right sort of way because it's a delicate subject. But like some groups do very well in Silicon Valley and other places and rise very quickly. If you're an Ashkenazi Jew, this group has been very successful and contributed enormously to the arts and to medicine and to science and things like that. Very, very not, you know, very smart group of folks. And you know, they've succeeded, you know, enormously in the U.S. and other parts of the world. A generation after the fucking people was genocided,
yeah,
like stuck in camps and half of them were killed. Yeah. Like the trauma of that is enormous. And one generation later are making incredible contributions to humanity. So
even before that, because they were always this tiny minority that had to make themselves very useful in a society or perish or be blamed. They were always being blamed for one thing or another.
Sure.
So to cut to the chase, you don't have to be delicate on the Brian Callen show. There's no delicacy here. We are, you know, very blunt people. But so the question is the success of the Ashkenazi Jews genetic or is it cultural? Is it primarily, and it can be a mix of both,
right,
but is it primarily genetic or is it primarily a function of certain values and attitudes that set humans to succeed up to succeed in a knowledge economy?
The rule of thumb that I use and some other folks use for trying to sort out nature versus nurture is like it's probably 50-50. Like they do a lot of these twin studies on things like height and personality and intelligence.
But I don't think the Jewish brain. I mean, yes, I suppose you could say that you grow up a certain way, but the Jewish brain, it's not like the Ashkenazi Jewish brain. The genome and that mathematical sort of comes down to a better machine. I don't think that's how it works.
Well,
I think that when things like innovation are prized in your culture, when in fact the founding father of your religion, Moses, set out to change time, there's a linear notion of the individual can actually change all of history. When that is the cultural touchstone that drives you and is, and you are reminded of that you as an individual can change the way things are done. You should always be innovative. That is what a man is at the end of the day. You don't have a homeland, so you better have some money to rely on. You better be needed in the society. Those needs and wants are what actually change the brain. I don't think that you're born a Jew. You take a Jew, you take an Italian, you put him in a room and the Jew, guys, all things being equal, the Jew is going to be an entrepreneur. Watch, this guy's going to invent a new form of stainless steel.
You're caricaturing it a little bit.
But when you start talking genetic, though, that's the danger. That's where
And because, I specified Ashkenazi because with Sephardim and what's the third?
I only know of Sephardic and Ashkenazi.
No, the third.
There are Jews in Ethiopia. The black Jew.
Mizrahi.
Yeah, the Mizrahi.
So you see this more in Ashkenazis and not in the other two groups. And you see it in success in Israel as well because it's a mix of the three groups. But, you know, Israel is an incredibly successful and innovative nation. You know, Tel Aviv and Israel in general is second only to Silicon Valley in terms of innovation. And it's, you know, a nation that is less than a century old. Yeah. And so to say, oh, you know, these people, grew up with the right culture, and so suddenly they're solving like differential equations better than everybody else, to me doesn't seem like a complete answer. It definitely seems like part of the answer, and we should learn from that. But you know, I think we're probably and there are also rare genetic diseases among the Ashkenazi population related to certain mental, like mental rare diseases that have to do with like neuron growth. Or overgrowth.
So firstly, let me just like lay this out. Yeah. Like firstly, we don't know all the genetics. They're not known. But it doesn't, to me, it doesn't really matter because, you know, I don't think anybody here is willing to engage in genocide, right? Or any sort of, you know, selective breeding program or anything like that, or eugenics or anything like that. Like going on of that sort of Christian moral principle, right? Like it's a good idea to just sort of like operate on the principle that all human life is worthwhile.
Absolutely.
Right. So, but that having been said, so we're not going to change humanity's hardware, right? We're not.
We're actually about to. I mean, like with CRISPR technology,
when that comes along. But
I know, but that's the next decade.
Yeah,
it's here.
But in the short term, right? What's available to us is that we can change humanity's software. We can update our culture, and there are values that we should be promoting. We should be defending internally within the United States,
yes.
And we should be promoting as shared human values. Because in terms of that cultural piece, I mean, you know, firstly. You know, a lot of this and what we've been doing, a lot of this is sort of cultural evolution, right? Different environments select for different cultures. And the Jews, for example, the Ashkenazi Jews are a part of what are called middlemen cultures, which are things like the overseas Chinese,
right.
The Japanese in Brazil, the Lebanese in West Africa, the Indians in East Africa. So all these cultures, and they all do very well. And it's because they're placed in a very particular environment. They're outsiders. They can't rely on the larger community. So they have to turn inwards. They support themselves and they become value hard work and all that sort of stuff. The Jews have a very particular historical experience, which is that they are constantly dispossessed, and so the only property that you can keep is knowledge. So that becomes the portable property. So, you know, oh, I have accountancy skills. They burn my village down. They steal all of that, but I can still move to Czechoslovakia and still have a job as an accountant. So there's real cultural evolution, and yes, these values and these beliefs and all that sort of stuff do make a huge difference. And if we're
but there are lots of groups of people that have been genocided throughout mm-hmm. history who don't bounce back.
That's true. I just worry that when we start talking about neurons and we start talking about brain types, that you are then putting a cap on on potential, human potential. That's the danger. I think that I don't actually believe that. I don't. I actually truly don't think there's any evidence right. scientifically really to suggest that one group has a biological, higher biological or lower biological potential than does another.
I mean, Tibetans have biological adaptations to get more oxygen
yes,
at high
they
altitude.
Yes,
and,
they
and
do.
So they're like
interferon works with Europeans,
but like
for certain diseases, it doesn't work at all with African American with people of African descent.
Right.
Yes, there are biological differences.
Right.
And they may be, but when you start talking about the brain being such a massively complicated organ, but I think that the evidence would suggest there are just too many examples of peoples of all different kinds
yes.
of cultures and races and biologies that were capable of doing incredible things and contributing
absolutely.
To the artistic and scientific and, you know, and all the different kinds of disciplines, all of those traditions significantly. So that's where, so I guess I don't have enough to go on to suggest that even if the brain is different, I can believe that the brains can be different. So I would believe that if one person has a brain tumor, a type of brain tumor, another person has a type of brain tumor, that this medicine would work on them because the chemistry of their brain is different.
Right.
And I do also think that you will find some people have brains that fire better, that are able to absorb things faster. Maybe we'll find this. So, I mean, it makes sense that one person could have a better machine, a machine that processes things faster,
right.
A machine that can create better patterns,
yeah.
A machine that has, for lack of a better description, better imagination, whatever that might be when we figure it out. Yes, I believe that. The danger is when you tie it to...
Sure. Yeah. You're right, which is why I sort of prefaced this,
yeah,
this whole segment.
It's
a delicate issue.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I do, there's a, in genetics, there's an asymmetry where a few mutations or like one or two mutations can cause big problems. If you get the, you know, recessive genes or something like that. And but it's really hard to create positive traits with just one gene flip because positive traits are very complicated. They're the, you know, many genes working together in concert. So when I think about, you know, CRISPR or other genetic editing technologies, I think it's going to help people who are closer to the bottom more than it's going to help people at the top. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be very hard for people who already, you know, were blessed with great athletics or great looks or a great sense of humor or great intelligence or great memory or whatever. I don't think it's going to help them that much. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to help the people who aren't blessed with that as much. So I realize it's a delicate subject. I'm cautiously optimistic that it could be a force for good.
Well, and the point is that, listen, we're pragmatists. We don't fucking care, right? I think that's fair, right? Like, whatever works, right? So I think, though, just to, like, provide a little bit more context on this, you know, I think the first thing to realize is the twin studies that you mentioned, right? So Richard Nisbett, who we've had on this podcast many times, actually wrote a book called Intelligence, How to Get It, right? And Nisbett studies culture. That's what he studies. And in fact, if you look at those twin studies and you look a little bit more carefully at them, you find that when you start to break them up socioeconomically, that you actually get very different results that sort of fit with what you're saying about CRISPR, which is that, you know, genetics, I can't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but essentially environment makes a very small difference for people who are sort of at the top of the socioeconomic ladder, if you're a twin that's raised in that environment, because essentially your environment's maxed out. There's not much more we can do. You're safe, you're secure, you have good food, you have all that sort of stuff.
You have a smart peer group.
That's right. Right. But the point is that in terms of raising up the bottom,
right,
then environment makes a huge, huge difference.
Yes.
And values and culture make a huge, huge difference. And so really, like, if you're a wise society, that's where you should be investing your energy is in trying to raise the bottom.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of, like, you know, the reality is that, like, we all have culture. We all have beliefs. We've all grown up in a certain environment. We've all internalized certain beliefs and assumptions and values. And, you know, my passion is education. And I moved out here and started hearing kids say things like, I didn't get the math gene, I don't have a natural ear for languages, all these beliefs, and then, you know, have been on a 12-year odyssey through the science. And, you know, all you have to do is if you put Asia next to America, right, and you have a culture that believes in the power of practice and human potential and hard work, and then a culture that believes that it is genetically doomed to fail, right, if things don't come easily.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes.
And crucially, you know, the United States, like 1776, the culture was, you know, and I've used this line a million times and I'm going to keep saying it until we have a real conversation about culture. You know, David McCulloch in 1776 has this line that it was a day and age that believed that a man by serious and diligent application to books could teach himself whatever was required. And that was the spirit of 76.
Right.
And you have people like Henry Knox who, like, taught themselves artillery. The guys who, you know, built the Erie Canal didn't go to fucking Harvard. They got some books and they read that. You know, Abraham Lincoln. Like, that's the point.
Can we stop here for a second? Yeah. Can we teach ourselves artillery, please?
Yeah,
that sounds like so much fun.
It's
yes!
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh. God, but, I'm so excited.
But, like, that's in terms of that equality, that's what I want. I want to return to that culture. And the thing that fucked it up, that fucked up that simple faith, was the eugenics movement, right? That's how, and, you know, Carol Dweck, we've also had on the podcast, Lewis Terman and all those guys promoted those ideas.
Yeah.
And so the point is that there's, you know, the reality is, I don't know what your cultural background is, where you grew up, but, you know, where'd you grow up?
Suburban.
In the forest. In the forest, yeah.
Suburban Michigan.
Right.
And my family is, like, English, Irish, and German.
Right. And so I you know, I think that it's, you know, there are all things that we're fighting against, right? And, you know, you're fighting against a sort of biological denialism that happens on the left.
Right.
And I 100% understand that, right?
Right.
And the challenge is for us to articulate a worldview that both recognizes the differences between certainly, like, men and women, and that's huge, right? But that also recognizes that we are creatures of belief and faith and culture and myths and all of that sort of stuff. And that, you know, the part of unlocking the potential that we have is that we need that core simple faith that, like, if you keep on at it and you keep on trying to improve yourself, you'll get a whole lot better.
Yep.
So that's...
Amen.
Amen. And...
Amen is right. I just want to say amen.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. Well, I think that it goes back to, you know, everybody here is trying to solve a problem and having an open and honest discussion about what you need to know who your enemy is. You need to know what the real problems are. And if you're not open to all sides of this and if you're not looking at the biology of it, you got some problems. It's a little bit like, you know, you know, if you don't eat well,
yeah,
good luck. It'll have an effect on your brain.
Right.
You know, it'll have an effect on how effective you can be. You know, there's all kinds of stuff you have to take into account. But I think the lesson learned is it's not just culture. Culture is very important.
It's gene culture.
Yeah.
Like if you were to take a group of men and men only, and they go create their own, you know, little society, they're going to have a different culture emerge from that than a group of just women. Like men, 100%. You might get 4chan, or you might get, you know,
right.
a sports barrack, or like army barracks, or like a sports locker room. And you put a bunch of women together, and, you know, you might get, you know, different, probably different things than that.
Well,
so there's a relationship between biology and culture.
Camille Paglia was talking about...
she's great.
She's
great.
I love her.
If she weren't a lesbian, can we try to convert
her? Dude, I'm telling you, I'm so attracted to her. I purposely watch old video of her when she was like 35. I think she's so hot. Short hair and just a fucking brilliant...
She's a firecracker.
Oh, she's a firecracker. And she was saying that there is a difference between a male and female brain. One of which was, why are so many men in history geniuses? Why are the great geniuses Freud, Copernicus, Galileo, Shakespeare, Newton? It just goes on and on. Maxwell, you can just keep going.
And
why?
The great monsters.
And the great monsters. Why? Why were the ones that really changed and moved the human condition forward and in some cases moved it backward? But for the most part, you know, these people that pushed the human condition forward pushed us past our biology. Why men? Why very few women? Very few women. Men have the ability to focus obsessively on one thing and literally forget about not only the children, forget the kids, go forage for your
personal
own food,
hygiene,
but everything personal, for real personal hygiene, even food. It's like that I was telling Hunter before this, I guess the most profound thing I'd never been able to shake. I've never thought I worked hard enough. And it's because when I read The Agony and the Ecstasy as a young man and probably a boy, Michelangelo had his ribs. He was just all skin and bone. And I think his girl at the time said, "Why are you not eating?" And Beatrice, and he said, "Because all of me has to go into the work. All of me must go into. I haven't time to eat." And he would even forget to sleep, and he would sleep on the cold marble. Then he went blind because the paint dripped in his eyes. And I was like, "I'm a fucking loser, dude. I'm not working hard at all. I got to get my sleep. And it's never at 50 years old in January. It's never stopped bothering me. So, but there are fundamental differences, is the point I'm making between.
Right.
There are biological differences. If you ignore the history, then you're lying. I know it'd be nice to think we're all the same. I know, like, Steven Pinker takes this on
right. In
The Blank Slate. You know, it used to be politically very, very incorrect to suggest that none of us are blank slate, that we all start as blank slates and social culture. And only socialization makes for a man or makes for a woman.
Yeah.
Only, you know, culture makes for aggression, creates aggression. No, aggression's inherent. And by the way, I hate to tell you, in a lot of primitive cultures, aggression is rewarded. And it's rewarded by women.
Yeah.
They want to fuck you if kill more men, more of the enemy. That's the Yanomamo.
Yeah,
hadn't been around any white guys or anything else. And when those anthropologists came back, their reputations were personally attacked by the academics who had this religion, who had this ideology, who had this Marxist ideology, which is what it is, this idea that we're all equal and that
it's
only
like
culture,
peaceful,
and that only
Edenic.
Culture and that only, you know, environment makes you what you are. Not true. Not true, not true.
Right.
Biology plays a huge part in the narrative of human history, of the human spectrum. Yes, 100%. The trick becomes, how do you not allow the fact that biology, which is a huge part of who we are, how do you how do you balance this idea that, yes, my biology, but what does that say about my potential? I suggest that you shouldn't even ask that question of yourself. What is, do I have a certain biology that's limiting? I do. I don't run fast enough to play in the NFL. I can't lift enough weight to be an Olympic weightlifter, damn it. I don't have the fast twitch muscle to win something in the high jump or dunk of basketball. That became very readily apparent when I was young. But it doesn't stop me from boxing. It doesn't stop me from flexing in the mirror and trying to get better looking.
Have you tried the high jump?
Yeah, I did high jump, and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't jump very high. Nobody ever told me, hey, dude, your peasant Irish-Italian genes suck for this particular event. But then I found wrestling, and I was great because I had the mentality. Not great, but I was a good wrestler. It gave me self-esteem.
You were born with cauliflower ears.
It made me feel like a fucking man, yeah. I just wanted to feel like a man. So this is the balancing act. Yeah. Sometimes maybe right. There are questions one shouldn't ask of themselves.
Yes.
It doesn't mean the science doesn't move forward. It doesn't mean you're not honest.
Right.
But we have to be careful about putting any limits on our potential.
I criticize social justice warriors for turning everybody into a victim. And even if you are a victim, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You will be more of one.
Well, it doesn't help you.
It doesn't help you. So I gotta look in the mirror and fight any type of determinism as well, because it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. Hunter, take the mic.
Well, I think the important thing is that, again, this goes back to what we were talking about before we started the podcast, is that humanity gets the most goodies when it is realistic. The more realistic we are, right? We got more realistic about how disease works. It turns out there are these little invisible creatures that are you can't see with the naked eye that cause disease, right? And, you know, like you talk about brilliantly in the Paleo Manifesto, there were, the mosaic code sort of dealt in some way with these invisible creatures. But then we got more realistic about these invisible creatures, and now we have antibiotics and all these sorts of things which we overuse and all of that stuff. But reality is where the best life possible comes from. And so I think that's the point. I think that, you know, it's about fearlessly looking at whatever the reality is and then figuring out how to harness it. And there are differences between men and women. And in, you know, to go back to my super PC-sounding global village comment, right? Like, within a village, there is this balance between hunter and gatherer behavior. And that's why that social organism works well. And you don't have to look at 4chan to understand what an all-male society would look like. It's most corporations. Like, it's all, you know... Yeah. And you know, it's not a healthy society because the reality is, yeah, they're all going out there and trying to kill. But, you know, that impulse can be constructive and can be creative. But there's also a need to sort of harmonize, to, you know, make sure that we're thinking in a socially responsible way and all of that sort of stuff. So I think the opportunity is to, you know, I just think like in terms of what my gay-sounding global village.
They're worse than my shoes. Your comment is worse than my shoes. I just like to clarify.
Yeah, there you go. But a lot of what I keep on thinking about is the Toyota production system, right? So Toyota has this great way, you know, in general, you find that Western culture innovates, like it creates shit. So we invent the TV, we invent, you know, mass production of cars, we invent telephones and all that sort of stuff. But then Asians make them way fucking better. And the reason why is because they have this holistic mindset that they favor, where they're trying to figure out how to harmonize and how to get all the pieces to work together well to maximize efficiency. And one of the things they do in the Toyota production system is they let everybody be the expert on the thing that they're the expert at. So the guy who puts the wheels on the car knows way more about how the challenges of that particular part than the guy who's in the head office. He doesn't know shit. And the guy who in the head office is like wise enough to come in and be like, I don't fucking know how this thing works. You tell me. And then...
But isn't that the ideal? Isn't that... Aren't we talking about globalism? Aren't we talking about sort of what free trade is all about? This country does it better than this country. You guys grow bananas way better than we do because we have a climate that's suitable to that. It's cheaper for you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the division
comparative advantage. And
yeah. I mean, what were you going to say, John? You were going to say something. I don't know. Oh. No, I think that we can start talking ourselves into a circle here, and that's what I worry about. It's like
and it becomes too abstract at some point.
Yeah, because I don't know about a global village, and I think that human beings are tribal, And I think that there's a lot of good, in fact, that comes from the divisions and from the differences and from the fact that people think differently and the fact that people even have prejudice and have tribal tendencies.
So can we talk about the Olympics real fast in relation to this? Do you think – so I think it's more fun to watch the Olympics when the athletes are ethnically from, like, the country that they represent.
Yeah, I get that. I get what you're saying.
Right? And, like, the Global Village Olympics, you lose the sense of nationalism.
Well, it's kind of a lie. I mean, this is what I'm kind of saying, is that what we actually love to watch is competition. Life is a fight. If you think that we are going to get along, we are, as long as there's enough water. The minute we have to compete for water and my kid might die of thirst, I'm going to fucking kill you, like you, but my kid's going to drink water no matter what. That's been the history. You know, it's like my buddy says, you're a nice guy, miss a meal and 4 hours of sleep. Come talk to me.
Right.
You know, there we need to learn, and we do. I think you've got to learn how to work within the very complicated human experience.
And if the global economy is growing and it's fairly broad-based growth, people will get along.
No such thing. Never will. See, that's the other thing. We have these – we strive for these things like fairness. We've got to solve these problems. I don't think we're always going to have – one thing we know is we're always going to run up against problems, haves and have-nots.
Yeah.
There's always going to be – there's going to be plain old death. I don't give a shit
how good CRISPR is. Status is zero-sum.
Like, yeah,
there can only be one funny
what I like about the United
LA.
States is that the United States has really figured out – you know, going back to the founding fathers, the U.S. – the United States – I think the glue, at least this is according to George Will, the glue that keeps our society together is we do have a lot of haves and have-nots, but the great thing about the American dream is that Americans all believe that someday they're going to be millionaires, that they at least have a chance. Like, I may be poor today, but you know, but I can celebrate your wealth because I'm going to be there someday too. That if we lose that, that's when you have this French Revolution. That's when you have real problems. So these are... Go ahead.
But the point is that that glue rests on a faith in human potential. It rests on the faith that, you know, if I do the work that I can achieve that, and it requires reality. You can't have a bunch of – that glue doesn't work when everybody sort of believes they're going to be a lottery winner and they're just going to come up with some widget that is like magically going to hand them all of the cash in the world. Now, the point is that if you were – like, let's imagine that the three of us here in this podcast had magic abilities, right? And we have the magic ability to suddenly restore America's faith in its potential for hard work and getting better and all that sort of stuff. What does that do to the economy of the United States? If everybody has that idea that by just learning from books, you can learn anything that you want, what does that do?
Grow faster.
A lot, right? So the point is that's a great value. That's a great belief. And why wouldn't you give that belief to every single culture on the planet? They can have whatever flag they want. They can have whatever nationality they want. But imagine if all of those values that make the Ashkenazi Jews, like loving knowledge, reading books, embracing mistakes, having a culture of dissent, what if we took that culture and put it in the Arab world? As it was in the time of the caliphate. How much more prosperous and wealthy and successful and less extremist would the Arab world be? So there are values that in the knowledge economy should be human universals. And it doesn't mean that we don't have flags and, you know, different cuisines and all those fun differences. I mean, you know, it will still feel like intramural sports at Harvard, right? Like Mather versus Adams versus Currier House versus whatever. But there are core values that can be universal and should be universalized and that we should promote both within our countries and we should promote around the world.
Well, that's a good way to end it.
Yeah. Time for artillery practice.
Let's go read some books on artillery. Speaking of magic, I want to show you guys my moves in bed. I got some fucking video.
Universalize that, Brian. It's unfair that your wife gets so much amazing sex, and most women are just starving.
Oh, we were talking about
sex. I don't have sex with my wife. That's disgusting.
Ugh.
What are you talking about? She's 39. Nah, fuck out of here. I'm talking about my girlfriends.
I saw the way she looks at you.
Yeah, with total disdain.
Yeah.
The way she rolls her eyes. John Durant, you have shed great light on And I like how practical you are, and I like your politics. I didn't vote for Trump, and I hope you're right about him, and I hope he's practical, and I hope that wins over his narcissism and other things. So we'll see. But I like the way you frame this, and we'll get you back.
Thanks for having an open mind.
Yeah, that's important. Now let's talk about let's shut this off and talk about paleo, CrossFit. And other shit that really matters.
But also, can I throw one
in? Hunter wants to throw in one more thing.
I want to throw out an invitation to John. And I think that, you know, while, you know, this election happened, there was Hillary, there was Trump. Trump won, you know. But I think the real opportunity is what we need is that we need a new set of founding fathers. I think we need to... No, I think we need to return to the core faith of America, and I think that there's a whole bunch of stuff that needs to be fixed, and we need to, you know, sort of figure out in terms of reality, not in terms of partisan politics, what is the most effective way to generate prosperity for all Americans? And do you want to be one of those founding fathers?
John?
If I understand what you're asking me is, do I want to start a revolutionary war and use violence to separate myself from the old system?
Yes!
Yes! I'm in! But yes, yes.
Not. Yes. I mean, that's the point. I think we do need people who know artillery, but not artillery. I mean, yes, we're going to learn how to blow shit up,
yes.
But we also need intellectual artillery,
yes.
Right? There's a battle for hearts and minds that needs
to
happen.
That is
amazing. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Brian, and you're our George Washington.
I love it. I got
George
it.
Washington was never the smartest one.
He wasn't.
No,
and I'm actually going to the dentist today at 4:30, where the dentist was like, "Dude, your teeth, it's a disaster. Why are you grinding so much?" I was like, "Cause I'm a type A personality, and I'm an actor, and I always feel like a failure." But discussions like this are fucking great. So thanks everybody for listening. This has been John Durant, Hunter Motz, Brian Callen. And this has been another episode of Mixed Mental Arts. God.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.